Right. Okay. So we're approaching Shabbat, Parshat Mas'e.
And today is the last day of frequency.
Marketing.
That's okay. We left it
back. You got the booth open?
Yeah, I can tell
where it's coming.
Ah. You saw me waving. But you saw me waving.
I didn't see you wave. I just saw you slowing down the car and somebody looking.
Ah.
She saw a person waving.
Sorry, Elliot.
No, that's all right.
Thank you. Okay. So it's Parshat Mas'e. And very often this is part of two Parshiot together, two Sidrot together. But this year it's separate. So we have Mas'e by itself. And it's the last section of Sefer Bamidbar, the last section of the Book of Numbers. And it begins off, if we just look at the text in the Torah, Eile Mas'e b'nei Yisrael, these are the journeys of the children of Israel, Asher yatzu me'eretz Mitzrayim l'tzivotam, by which they went out of the land of Egypt by their hosts, Biyad Moshe ba'Aaron, at the hand of Moses and Aaron. So now what this really is, it's a list of stopping places. They went out of Egypt and they came to a certain place. From that place they went to a third place. And from there they went somewhere else. And so on. Vayichtov Moshe et Motzaehem. Moses wrote down where they came from, lemasehem, by their travels, al pi Hashem, by the mouth of God. Ve'ele mas'eyem lemotzaehem, and these are their travels according to where they came from. It's a strange expression. This, it seems, it's saying something extra. So let's just look at a few of them. By Yisu Meramses, they went from Ramses. Now Ramses is in Egypt. When we go to the British Museum, we can see things that have been stolen from Ramses. And Bachodesh HaRishon, in the first month, that's the month of Nisan, B'chamisha Asa Yom LaChodesh, on the 15th of the month, LaChodesh HaRishon, on the 15th of the first month, that's Pesach, that's the first day of Pesach. Mimochadat HaPesach, the day after they offered the Pesach offering. The Pesach offering, the Paschal lamb, was slaughtered on the 14th of the month. They ate it that night. And at midnight was the death of the firstborn of the Egyptians. And then the next morning they went free. Yatzu b'nei Yisrael b'yad ramad, the children of Israel went out with a high hand. Le'ineko Mitzrayim, in the eyes of all Egypt. Now, let's miss a verse, go on to verse 5. Vayisu b'nei Yisro me'Ramses, the Israelites traveled from Ramses, vayachanu b'sukkot. They camped at a place called Sukkot. Now, Sukkot is really outside Egypt. So they've got to the, they were at Ramses, then they traveled and they came to Sukkot. Vayisu m'sukkot, they traveled from Sukkot, vayachanu b'eitam. They camped at Eitam, Asher Bikzeh HaMidbar, which is on the edge of the desert. Vayisu me'Eitam, and then they traveled from Eitam, Vayashav al pi Achirot, Asher al Pnei Baal Tzafon, and they turned back to a place called Pi Achirot, near Baal Tzafon, and Vayachanu lifnei Migdal, and they camped before Migdal, and then they traveled on from there, and it gives a whole list. If you look on the next page, it goes on giving this list. And in fact, I haven't printed the whole list here, but it's altogether 42 stopping places. And they travel, and you see this long list on the other side, just going on. They left this place and they camped there. They left that place and they camped somewhere else, and so on. Until they come to Yarden Yerecho. That's the end of the account, which isn't written here. Now, there are a lot of discussions about this, and the question is the relevance of this to us in our personal lives, given that every word of Torah is supposed to be significant, and it's supposed to be teaching something. So we have two or three pages of text of the Torah with the question, what exactly does it mean? And this is addressed by many Chabad Hasidic Kabbalistic discourses, beginning with Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi in the 18th century, the end of the 18th, the beginning of the 19th century, and into the late Lubavitcher Rebbe. And this is a discourse that he said in 1984, which was not edited. And I didn't have one of these publications with Biur. They didn't have one, or I couldn't find one for this. And so that's what we're going to be exploring, this discourse of 1984 on this journey. Of course, 1984 is a very significant year from the George Orwell point of view. But... and no doubt everything fits together in some spiritual way. So in order to enter the mood of the maimer, the discourse, there is the melody of the discourse. And the melody of the discourse goes approximately like this. Ya yam ba ya ya yo ya yo. Ha yira yira yam bam ayam bam ba yadam bam bam bum ha yira dam ba ya yira dam bam bum ho ya yira dam ba ya ya ho ya yira dam ba yam ba yom ha yira dam ba ha yira dam ba ho yamba ya ya yira dam bam ha ya yamba yira dam bam ho ya da ho ya da do eile mas e. Now we're going on to the Hebrew text. Eile mas e bnei Yisrael, these are the journeys of the children of Israel. Asher yatzu me'eretz Mitzrayim biyad Moshe, which they went out of Egypt by the hand of Moses. Vayichtov Moshe, and Moses wrote et motza eim lemas eim, where they came from according to their journeys. Ve'eile mas eim lemotza eim, and these are their journeys according to where they came from. Right, that's the verse. And that verse unlocks a door. And first of all, there come a number of questions about the verse. Hine yadua hadil kaklali baze. It is known, the general question about this. Hamuvam mehadrushim belikutei Torah, which is understood from the teachings in a book called Likutei Torah, Selections of Torah Teachings by Rabbi Shneur Zalman. Ubadrushim shel achaze, and in the Chabad Hasidic discourses after that, madua haricha haTorah besipur hamasaot. Why does the Torah tell us at such length about these journeys? Vahari lechaora, surely at first sight, ma'ida hava hava. Now this is a very cute expression which we find a number of times in the Talmud. What happened, happened. So what? So it happened. If the Torah is telling us a law, you know, you should put a mezuzah on your doors. Okay, so it's telling us something we're supposed to do. You could say that there are certain things we won't understand unless it gives us, you know, the basic description of going out of Egypt. But when you go into such detail, exactly where they went in the desert, I mean, obviously, this text that we've just read a little bit of is a treasure trove for modern day archaeologists and people who want to, you know, map out the area around the land of Israel and try and identify these biblical places. And very often there are, you know, some kind of Arab name for that area, and the, you know, whether it relates to the biblical name or not, or, you know, so there's it's a wonderful area for research. But as far as the Torah goes, Maida Haba Haba, what happened happens. So, but Umikivan Sheinyan Masaot Bnei Yisrael, since this account of the journeys of the Israelites, who chelik mitorat chaim, is a part of the living Torah, Shehi Hora Nitzrit, which is an eternal teaching. Now you see, this is the basic approach, both of the Talmud and of the Kabbalah, that every word in the Torah is in some way significant, and that there's something or other to be learned. The Talmud, if it doesn't find a halachic way of teaching from those texts, it will present a kind of agadic way, a midrashic way. So there are different ways. Rashi quotes different ways of looking at this. He gives a description of a king whose son was ill, and he took him to get him cured. And then on their journey back, the king is recounting, you know, we went here and this happened, and we went there and that happened. You know, the idea of memory. It's a very interesting idea, this concept of memory. Do you have handy? Wait a minute, I've got a Chumash Rashi here.
This is Rashi.
Yeah, that's right. I just want to find it to quote it more precisely.
Which one do you want?
It's for this week's parsha. Wait a minute, I've got it here. Handy Chumash Rashi. Well, and a few other things in this, this publication. So Rashi says, why were all these stopping points, these journeys written down? The first point, he says, is to teach us how kind God was. Even though God told them they would have to journey for 40 years in the desert, you can't say that they were all the time moving in a very restless way, and you know, every few days they were traveling off somewhere, because in fact there were only 42 places. So on average, if it was one, it could be one place per year, one movement a year. And in fact it was less than that, because when they left Egypt, they went a whole series of stages all at one go. They went a whole lot, and also later on at the end of the 40 years there was a sort of, they went quite a few, so you have to subtract 14. So it's well less than one stage a year. So it wasn't such a restless experience. So that's one explanation why it's all written down. And then we have from Tanchuma, from the Midrash Tanchuma, a king whose son was ill, and he took him to a distant place to heal him. And when they came back, his father counted all the different places they'd been. This is where we slept, this is where it was cold, this is where you had a headache, and so on. So this thinking over times past, thinking over the events, and it's an interesting metaphor. This idea of, you know, going somewhere to be healed, and then you know, there's a whole drasha, there's a whole exploration which could be made just about that. So that is a way in which, so that's from Midrash Tanchuma. So the Midrash wants to see, what do we get from this passage? What is this passage telling us? And in a sense, it's saying, you know, there's something to be, something meaningful about thinking back over the past. It's an interesting question. It's the whole idea of past. Say, an anthropologist wrote it was a young woman who used to come here, who was studying anthropology in Cambridge, doing a PhD or postdoctoral. So she recommended to me a certain book, which it's called Religion as a Chain of Memory. So the whole idea of a chain of memory as being part of or an essential part of religious experience, this chain of memory concept. So here we have indeed a chain of memory so that's one way of looking at it, which is an interesting way. However, the Kabbalistic and Hasidic tradition has its own approaches to looking at it. So what is the eternal teaching in this? Five lines down at the end of the line, the Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Moses commanded to us the Torah, Morasha ki hilat Yaakov, it's the inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. Hainu shekola Torah kula, that means the entire Torah, hi Yerusha, is an inheritance, l'chol echad v'achat Yisrael, to every single Jew. Every single Jewish man and woman has the inheritance of Torah. Hari muvan, so it's understood, she'inyan ha-mas'ot, that this concept of these stopping places, this journey, or they're not called stopping places, I'm calling it stopping places because that's the most convenient English word, but in fact they're journeys, they're movements, this series of 42 movements, yesh bo tochen v'hora'a, has within it a content and a teaching, l'chol echad v'achad Yisrael, to every individual Jew, b'chol zman, in every epoch, u'b'chol makom, and in every place. Shaharei ha-Torah hi nitzchit, because the Torah is eternal. Now, so that concept, that the Torah applies to each of us, in everywhere, in every time, so that means long after the events which are described, now as well, and wherever we are, and to each one of us as an individual. V'lachein katav Moshe et ha-masa'ot. That is why Moses wrote down these journeys. It seems to emphasize in the verses that Moses wrote down the journeys. Ki mizeh yesh hora miyuchedet. This has got a special teaching. Ba'avodat ha-adam, in the service of the individual. B'chol makom v'chol zman. In every place and in every time. And because it's something so significant, he wrote it down. And it says he wrote, I mean, obviously he wrote it down because it's in the Torah, but it actually tells us that he wrote it down. Very rarely does the Torah tell us, and Moses wrote down. It says it a few times. Normally we understand the Torah is written by Moses. But here it's emphasizing that Moses wrote down this list. So in other words, there's a question. The first major topic, which is the whole theme, is what are these 42 journeys in the life of an individual or the life of the Jewish people as a whole? There's another question which is asked. Or other questions. Various details in the text. It says Moses wrote down where they came from by their journeys, and these are their journeys by where they came from. And then he says in brackets, just by the way, we have a very similar expression, gabei limud tzurat beit hamikdash, concerning the description of the form of the temple in the book of Ezekiel. Motza'ov u'mova'ov. It's places that you go out and the places that you go in, but it's rather similar to the expression over here about journeys. Shezeu al derech masa'ot, mova'ot u'motza'ot. He's comparing the phrases in the description in the book of Ezekiel. The Book of Ezekiel is a fascinating work of prophetic vision. And towards the end of the book, there is a vision of the third temple. Ezekiel the prophet is taken by an angel and shown round the third temple. And there's a description of it, which commentators, you know, try to reduced to something tangible that we can like draw a diagram of. You can get books, like very nicely produced modern books, where they try to give a drawing of the temple, the third temple, as described in the Book of Yitzchak. And the Rebbe here is comparing the phraseology, that it's as if this going out and coming in of the temple is which we might say are like all the entrances. The description of the temple in Ezekiel is very much about gateways. There are gates, and the gates have special structures, like around the gate and before you get into the gates and then coming from the gates. So it's very much about gates. It's interesting. I mean, Kabbalistic thought, of course, gates are very important. The gates of wisdom and 49 gates of understanding leading to the 50th gate. And quite a number of Kabbalistic books are written using the word gate, gate of love, gate of awe, gate of... And
Sharei Tzedek.
Sharei Tzedek. Well, yes, gates of righteousness, which is the name also of a hospital in Israel, where everyone should be well. But yes, the concept that then you have gates of Jerusalem. You've got gates of the temple, gates of Jerusalem, and spiritual gates. In fact, there's Nodabash Arim Ba'ala in the Eshet Chayil, the praise of the Jewish woman, which is said on Friday night. It's a description from the end of the Book of Proverbs. It's a description of the woman of valor. Woman of valor who can find, and it goes to a whole description. Her husband doesn't seem to do very much in this description. But what he does do, he's Noda'a b'sharim. He's known at the gate. You know, he's sitting around at the gate drinking tea while she runs this business and does all kinds of wise things. But he's there at the gate. So Noda b'sharim ba'ala, her husband is known at the gate, so there's a comment on that. Each one according to his own gate. Each one has their own gate, their own measure. So the idea of a personal gate. So we have the concept of these personal gates, these temple gates, and the idea of writing down about the gates, and the comparison that's being made here is that the gates are like the journeys, which is interesting. This concept is incidentally not addressed later in this discourse. It's just put as a comment over here, and is like something to meditate on, the comparison between the 42 journeys and the gates of the temple, and or different aspects of the temple, and the way that they're both have a similar phraseology. It's strange that just here it says Vayichtov Moshe, Moses wrote. V'harei kol haTorah nichtava al yedei Moshe. Surely the whole Torah was written by Moses. V'chein mal kefil alashon. Then there's another point. Why does it put it in this double way? Not only does it say he wrote Vayichtov et motzeim lemaseim, where they came from and where they traveled, and then it says Ve'ele maseim lemotzeim, and these are their travel, where they traveled according to where they came from. Why does it put it in two ways? The answer it's going to give, it's two dimensions of spiritual movement. And so and one aspect of it might be a movement from above to below and then below to above, and also aspects of connecting the soul to above, because the soul is connected to above, which is one kind of connection to one's source. Because of that, the soul here in this world is able to make steps forward. So this idea of movement, and so there are different dimensions of connection in order that this movement is able to take place. V'gam masha mishanet haseda, and also the fact, not only does it repeat it, it puts it in the other way round. First it says from there where they came from to where they journeyed, and afterwards it puts it the other way round, and it writes these are their journeys according to where they came out. In other words, the double expression said twice and said A B and then B A. So that will be that will come up at the end of the discourse in the kind of way I just mentioned about two different aspects of connection and movement enabling us to move here in this world spiritually, because really we're talking about spiritual movement. Now, as a preface to understanding the concept of this spiritual movement, ulahavin kolze, to understand all this, yesh lahakdim bir klalot inyan hamasaot, we first of all have to understand in general what are these journeys all about. Why were all these journeys? Well, of course, the simple answer is because the 12 spies spied out the land, and 10 of them gave a very depressing report, and the people said they wanted to go back to Egypt, and because of that God said, just as the spies went 40 days round the land of Israel, so the Jews will wander 40 years in the desert. And that's written in the biblical text. But whether it's Talmud, Midrash, Kabbalah, Hasidic thought, it's never satisfied with just what it says in the biblical text. That's a part of it, and that will explain a certain aspect of it. So one of the things the Midrash says, Hine yadua ma shekatub b'midrash, it's known what the Midrash says, and he gives here note 10, a sort of a list of different collections of Midrash which give this idea. Shetam arichut ha-masa'ot, the reason for these long journeys, in other words, the 40 years in the desert, Hayah kedei sheyimtzu achakach be'eretz Yisrael, is so that afterwards they would find in the land of Israel batim meleim kol tov, houses filled with all good things. As if for 40 years the Canaanites were somehow stocking up in their houses. Maybe they were stocking up for a siege. Maybe that's the way the Midrash conceives it. And so they were stocking up good things, and then finally when the Jews did come into the land of Israel, there they had these houses filled with good things. And there wasn't the United Nation at that point. And so Omnam tzarich lahavin, but this is also strange. The lechora, at first sight, im hayu yotzim mitzrayim, if they'd have left Egypt, Ubay miyad le'eretz Yisrael, and coming at once to the land of Israel, kedeperish Rashi, as Rashi says, shahaya efsheliot b'shlosha yamim, could have been in 3 days. They could have gone from Egypt and come to the land of Israel in 3 days. Lo haya l'umot p'nai l'kalkel, the inhabitants, hi, the inhabitants of the land of Israel would not have had time to destroy what they had. In other words, you know, one might imagine that if the Canaanites are retreating before the Israelites, that the Canaanites might destroy everything they had, but if it was all in 3 days, there wouldn't have been the time. It's like a practical question about the Midrashic image. But It's just doing this in order to bring us back to a more spiritual interpretation of what these 42 journeys are, the 42 journeys from Egypt to Israel, which in fact are the journey of the entire Jewish people or the journey of each individual. Ve'im kein tzarich lahavin lama haya tzarich liot inyan ha-masa'ot b'shul zeh. So therefore, the Midrash doesn't give a sufficient explanation to why there had to be these 42 journeys, these 40 years in the desert. Va'od, and a further point, the ma she'ha'aricha ha-Torah, the fact that the Torah speaks at such length, b'sipur ha-masa'ot, telling the story of the journeys, muchach she'inyan ha-masa'ot eino rak B'tor Hemshech. It's not just a continuation, the Masha Haya Lifneze, of that which was before, or Hachana L'Mashiyah La'achazeh, or preparation to that which is going to be afterwards. Elahu Inyan Bifnei Atzmo. The whole concept of 42 journeys in the desert is something in itself. It's a significant concept. There's going out of Egypt, there's coming into Israel. Right, those are both beautiful things. But in the middle there are these 42 journeys, and those 42 journeys, sheyesh bo tochen b'hora'ah, it's got a content, it's got a teaching, b'fnei atzma in itself, liyoto chelek b'torat chaim, because it's a part of a Torah of life, hora'ah b'chaim, a teaching of life. Okay, so now we're coming to a simple Kabbalistic explanation, and we're going to consider that. Gam yadua habir bipnimiyut ha'inyan. Now, it's well known, the explanation in inner terms, and he quotes footnote 9, which is to the teaching on this by Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the first Chabad Rebbe, she'inyan ha'masa'ot bamidbar, that the concept of the journeys in the desert, haya inyan avodat ha'berurim, was the concept of the service of sifting. Berurim means sifting. Now, is anyone aware of what this concept of sifting means in this context? David, sifting?
In a normal sense, it's taking the fine from the coarse.
Now, that's an interesting thing. In the laws of Shabbat, one of the things one isn't supposed to do are all the processes which lead to baking a loaf. So you have wheat, and you grind the wheat, and then you sift, or maybe it's before that, you sift the good from the bad. You're cleansing what you've got, and so you're taking out the negative from the positive. So as such, it's one of the things, an activity, like a daily activity involved in baking, which we can't do on Shabbat, and that applies to other things as well. However, here it's a more general Kabbalistic dimension. Now, in order to explain this, we have to consider the nature of existence, and that existence is a mixture of, it's got a very, very sacred component, which is so sacred that it is too intense, that in fact it's dangerous. It's an interesting concept. That in the world around us, there's a sacred component which is so intense that it's dangerous. Now, the Lurianic Kabbalah goes into a whole explanation of how this comes to be part of the world around us, and he gives us a teaching about what's called the breaking of the vessels. But without going into that, let's just look at the existence as it is, that there is a kind of dangerous spiritual spark or element in many things around us, which have a force, an attractive force. And it makes us, it draws us, it's trying to draw us towards it. And we have to hold back. And life is a process of this holding back from this negative dimension, or taking a genuinely positive dimension and using that in a good way. It has to do with physicality. It's the paradox of physicality. And so therefore, you see, in a spiritual realm, if we can imagine for a second, like spiritual realm, what's different about a spiritual realm to a physical realm? In the spiritual realm, godliness is obvious. In a physical realm, godliness is hidden. So what we see, instead of godliness in the physical realm, we see human beings, material things, which may well exert an attractive force on us. Now, sometimes that's a very appropriate attractive force, and sometimes it's totally inappropriate. And so what our life is, to a great extent, is a sifting process from moment to moment, whether in our actions, what we touch, what we take, what we try to possess, or in our words, or even in our thoughts. There's this sifting process taking place. And it's a kind of a continuous struggle that the person faces. You know, an event takes place and you're suddenly filled with rage, or and then you have to control that, or struggle to control them. And or some other emotion which is inappropriate for that situation, and you have to try to control that. And so we're all the time, it's a little bit like driving, a constant process of driving, all the way, all the time. You're swerving away from some obstacle, and then there's a bicyclist, so you have to swerve back. driving is a very, very good metaphor for spiritual life. And one of the things about it is you always have to keep your eye on the road. You can't rest for a second. You can't relax, otherwise that would be... You can learn how to relax in that process, but the attention always has to be. And that's exactly this spiritual battle. And so there is an idea that the 40 years in the desert, and walking through the desert, going through all the different parts, these different parts of the desert, was achieving this sifting process, this spiritual sifting process, in the desert, in this way. And so that's a way that, you know, a simple, straightforward way, if simple is the right word, that Kabbalistic and Hasidic teachings often describe this. The reason why they had to go through the desert for 40 years was in order to accomplish the work of sifting, which then would enable us later on in the land of Israel and later through our history to deal with the world as we face the world. Now, there's an interesting question asked here, which I haven't actually seen anywhere else. Omnam, however, gam ze doresh birur, this also needs explanation. Da hare inyan habirur, because this concept of sifting in the normal sense, shayach l'cha'ora, at first sight, it seems relevant, רק במקום שיש שם יישוב אדם. It only applies, or mostly applies, in a place where people live, in an inhabited area. מה שאין כן רוב המסעות, but most of these 42 journeys היו במדבר, were in the desert, שהוא מקום אשר לא ישב אדם שם, where, and that's a place where, which was uninhabited. Milvad ma'masaot achadim, apart from a few of the journeys or stopping places, shaitam ahem behem milchamaim umat olam, they had battles with other nations. Hare rov ha'masaot hayu b'midbar, most of the journeys were in the desert. Now, it's an interesting idea. The whole process of driving is completely different if you're driving over a flat, seamless terrain. When I was a little boy, I had a friend who would teach me driving rather illegally, but so we would go to a disused airfield, which was a beautiful stretch where you could just drive and there was like nothing there, you know. And so the whole situation, of course there's a lot of things to go wrong with that, the whole process of birur, of this sifting, this choice, this self-control, it's really a response to the challenge which other people present. The fact that there are other people and there are the possessions and the persons of other people, that is what means one has to control one's love and one has to control one's anger. And if there's no one else there, if you're just there alone in the desert, you don't have the same kind of challenge. It's an interesting concept.
But what they're doing is learning the structure of how to go through those gates and how to learn those different things in the wilderness.
So you're saying that the wilderness is like an easy...
it's almost like an abstract.
It's an abstract situation.
Within that abstract situation, there are forms that they are learning,
mm-hmm.
which sort of tie in with that memory thing where you have places and routes in between and gates.
Mm.
And somehow they're learning this structure in preparation for going to Israel.
It's a very interesting way of putting it. And it's certainly a sense in which there's some preparation for life and for history which is taking place. And I think that's very interesting, and you'll see the way that that relates to the next paragraph.
And you can obviously take it at a personal level as well, which is what
That is very interesting. All right, so the second paragraph on this page, 421. V'yuvan kol zeh, all this will be understood to some extent. Al pi hayadua, according to what is known, quoting Tanya, shetachlit kavanat habriyah, that the purpose, the goal of creation, hima shenitaveh kadosh baruch hu, is the mysterious desire of the infinite God, liot lo yitbarach, that he should have dira betachtonim, a dwelling in the lower world. In other words, that the world, now this is a paradox, the world in itself is a concealment of God. In fact, the very word for world, as we often, doesn't seem very forceful. Sorry. Now, you can write the word world with a vav over here, but this is ha-olam, the world. But it has the same letters, not the same vowels, but the same letters as the word he'elem, concealment. So the very word for world, the world that's created by God, is actually a concealment of God. So this world that we're looking at. Is a concealment of the divine. And yet, what is the paradoxical purpose of the divine? To have a dwelling in this lower world. That here, living in a world of concealment, we should conduct ourselves in such a way that in some way the divine is manifest. So, for example, if a person is very beautiful in their behavior and their relationships and kind and loving and generous, holy, there is a way in which godliness is being manifest. You're going to say something?
No.
So it's a way in which godliness is manifest, or there might be beautiful Torah teachings, or beautiful spiritual expression in some way, beautiful melody, beautiful painting, which in some way expresses something sacred, and so the world becomes a dwelling for the divine. V'hainu sheyeh ba'olam, and that means there should be in the world, lo rak biru ha'olam b'zikuch ha'olam, not only the sifting of the world. You see, before we had the idea of sifting, choosing good from bad, rejecting bad, and choosing good. Not only the sifting of the world, v'zikuch ha'olam, the purification of the world. See, if there is some piece of world which is very tempting but is inappropriate, and we reject it, which is the right thing to do, there is a sense in which that thing is elevated. The thing which is trying to attract us in the wrong path is actually being elevated by our keeping away from it. And there's a dramatic metaphor for this process in the Zohar, where the Zohar says that there was a king who wanted to test his son, and the way that he did this was that he called a beautiful harlot to come and try to attract his son. And the whole idea is that the son should stand up against the attractions of the harlot and say, no, no thank you. And that would refine him. And also, it is the real goal for her as well, because she wants that the son should not give in to her. That's what she wants, because she knows that the king has only put her there in order that to improve the character of the son. It would be a downfall if the son gave in to her. So the same, all negative things. You see, we have to consider that the world is created for each of us, each one of us as an individual. So each one of us as an individual is surrounded by a whole world. And that world has all kinds of different temptations in it. And those temptations are only in order for us to avoid them. That's why they were created. And so by us avoiding that temptation, that's the aliyah, that's the ascent, the spiritual ascent for that thing. That's why that thing was put in the world, for us not to fall into it. Why? Who dug that stupid hole in the road so that I should drive past it and not ruin my tire driving into it? So that's life all the way through. However, this is only one part of it. To avoid, you see, the process of sifting, avoiding bad, choosing good, that's one part of it. But not only that, the world should become a dwelling for God, lo la'atzmuto, for the essence of God. Like in an ordinary dwelling, a literal dwelling, the very essence, shel hadar, of the person who lives there, nimtza ba'adira, is found in the dwelling. When you have someone living in a home, the home expresses the personality of the person who lives there. The pictures on the wall, the kind of furniture, whether there's carpet or whatever it is, it all expresses the way in which that person looks at life. That's given that they are able to control their environment a little bit. And so the place where they live takes on their own character. So God wants us to live in the world and not only avoid bad and choose good, but also live in such a way that the essence of the divine is being expressed, and that somehow this worldly domain that we're in expresses the very essence of the infinite. So it is like this above, four lines down in the second paragraph on page 421. Last word. The dwelling is for the essence of God. The dwelling has to be in the lower realm. That means on the very lowest level of existence. Now, as you understand, when we say a dwelling in the lower world, we don't mean lower just spatially. Lower means lower in level. Now, what does it mean higher in level, and what does it mean lower in level? The thing that is more subtle and spiritual is higher. And the thing that is more coarse and material is lower. That's basically the way it's seen in these texts. So the idea is that on the more coarse and material level, that's where godliness should be revealed. That on the most coarse and material level of life, that's where the essence of the divine should be revealed. So not just, you know, you might imagine a person doing some very spiritual activity. So, so you can imagine holiness in that very spiritual activity. But what about a very coarse, material, physical activity? these Hasidic teachings emphasize that there too the infinite godliness should be expressed. And it even tells us in the next few words, Ki chol ha-gvoha gvoha biyoter, whatever is higher, yored lamata mata biyoter, descends to the lowest point. So in other words, that which is on the lowest level of materiality actually comes from the highest level of the spiritual. So what we think as something coarse and material is really potentially connecting us to the highest level of spirituality. And the challenge is to approach it in that way, with that kind of sensitivity. Shemizem uvan, and from this we can understand, shedavka v'tachtonim, that it's in this lower world, precisely, yeshno nitzutz hachi gavoh, there is the highest kind of spiritual spark and radiance. V'lachein atachtonim davka, and therefore it's in this lower world, Na'asim ledira lo yitbarach, they become a dwelling for God. Lo la'atzmuto, for his essence. U'bishvil ze, and it's for the sake of this, yarda gam kein hanshama, the soul descended, lemata, below, into this world. As the sages tell us, me'igra rama, from a high roof, libera amikta, to a low pit. That's what life looks like from the point of view of the soul. It was on a high roof, it was on this very, very exalted spiritual level. The Talmud speaks of the souls being under the throne of glory, and then it comes into this world, into this low pit. Bichdei, in order, levarer ta'olam, to sift the world, ulezakcho, to make it pure, lahaloto, to elevate it. So that's one aspect of the work, of the task. Va'ad sheyaseh ledira lo yitbarach, and then becomes the second aspect, till it becomes a dwelling for God, lo latzmuto, for the very essence of God. Now,
does it mean that the role of the neshamot is to prepare the world for Kadosh Baruch Hu to come?
Yes. Yeah. Our body is a kind of intermediary between us and the world. It's like it's the body drinks and eats, breathes from the world. It's clothed by things that grow in the world. So the body and so the body really relates to the world. The neshama, the soul, is there inside the body. And the role of the neshama is to create this dwelling for God in the body and through that in the world. Yeah. To elevate and transform existence. So the neshama comes, the soul comes into the world with a task.
So it's through the personal body, not generally to prepare the world, but to prepare the body that the neshama is.
Well, it's both. I mean, it might be preparing the world in a more direct way. It might be helping other people to deal with the challenge of life.
Maybe the neshama after death or before birth is busy doing these things.
In an upper world.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, the neshama wants to do it, even when it's in an upper world. But in the upper world, it's not able to. It's in a realm of pure spirituality. It's coming down into this paradoxical existence that the neshama is faced with that opportunity, that challenge and opportunity.
And it can come down only inside a body, through a body.
Mostly, yes. I mean, there may be more than one neshama associated with a particular body. There's a concept of ibur, that a person can have another soul nesting in them for a time.
That's neshama yetera?
That's another concept.
Oh,
the idea of an extra soul that we get on Shabbat. There's an idea that Shabbat is a very spiritual time. We get an extra soul. So there's different spiritual dimensions.
Sorry, I interrupted you. You said ibur of neshama.
Well, ibur means literally pregnancy, but it means that a person can get a certain other soul nesting in them for a time, like pregnant. They're pregnant with that soul. But that means they're being given a spiritual input by a soul which is helping them at a particular stage in life. It's, and it might be there for a certain time and then go away, but it's there to help them accomplish certain things.
I know that my grandfather said to my father when he was a child that he has neshama yetera. What does it mean? That for temporarily he got another soul?
Well, he might say, he probably meant that you're a very spiritual person, he said to your father. You've got an extra soul. That's the neshama yetera is like an extra soul. So there's a concept of an extra soul on Shabbat. When it's the end of Shabbat, there's a ceremony called Havdalah. We light a candle, have a glass of wine, and also some fragrant spices. And we smell the spices with the idea that we need to be revived after Shabbat has finished, because the extra soul has gone away, and so we feel faint. So we smell the spices to revive ourselves. So that's part of the... So there's like a multi-candle. It's not one wick candle. It's a candle with several wicks, because fire was created at the end of Shabbat, the first Shabbat. Adam organized a fire somehow. And so that fire we commemorate, but also there's the smelling of spices because of the extra soul that we had on Shabbat, which has now gone away. So so that's a... All right, so this paragraph has outlined our task. Now, how does this relate to the whole idea of the 42 journeys? Let's see the next paragraph. Vihine, and behold. Mikevan, so this is on page 421, the third paragraph. Vihine, behold, mikevan shavodat ha'adam ilasot lo yitbarach dile betachtonim. Since the task of the person is to create a dwelling for God in the lower world. The meaning of this is Kaniska Leil, is as we said before. Not just to purify the world and to elevate it, but a second stage, that the world should become a spiritual dwelling for God. Lo latzmuto, for his very essence. So it's like there are two parts to this task. One is keeping oneself, you know, if we take the driving image, you know, you could say one task in driving is not to bump into anything. But the other task is you've got to get somewhere and do something. So what are we trying to get to? We're trying to get to the point where godliness fills the world and dwells in it and is expressed in it. So we can understand that in order that each individual should have hakoach, the power, lasot et ha'olam ha'tachton, to make the lower world lidira la'atzmuto yitbarach, into a dwelling for God's essence, tzarich al zeh, we need for this lenitinat koach miuchedet lemaila, a special kind of empowerment from above. Kamaima, as the sages tell us, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ozro, the Holy One helps him. In other words, there's some kind of divine empowerment, divine input that comes into us, which enables us to make the world into a realm where godliness is expressed. V'od zot, and further, the Ein Zeh Rak Be'ofen Shu Oved Avodato. It's not the way in which a person does his or her service, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ozro, and God helps him or her. There has to be from the beginning, from above, there has to be some kind of transformation of the lower world, sifting through the lower world. After that sifting has taken place from above, then the individual, through his or her service, who, through his or her own service, we are able to then transform the world. So in other words, and make it a dwelling for the divine. So in other words, there has to be some kind of divine input into this process. Now, so let's just try to figure this out. There's, the wrong batch of pens. So here's the world, right? Lots of stormy and problematic things over there. And so we, the person, has the task in this world to somehow make this world into a dwelling for the divine. Now, in order for us to do that, there has to be some kind of input from above, both an input to us, and in some sense, an input to, a spiritual input to the world, which is going to make us have the power to transform the world. There has to be some divine something happening to the world, and also something happening to us, we'll see later, so that we're able to achieve this task. It's not something we can just do ourselves. Keeping away from bad and doing good may be, even there, I mean, you know, this comment that God helps us, it's in the Talmud. And what it's actually saying then, as it's also quoted in Tanya, the idea, a person has a good desire and a bad desire. So the good desire pulls him one way, and the bad desire pulls him the other way. So it's an equal fight. How are we going to manage? God helps the person make a good choice, ideally, you know, when everything's working well. God helps a person make a good choice. So even to make a good choice of good against bad, we need this divine input. And there are all kinds of different ways that we get a divine input to help us in this daily struggle. You know, and being sensitive to the divine input is an important thing. But here we've reached another stage in the whole process, that there's some grander goal that we're trying to achieve. And for this grander goal, we need a more intense empowerment and some kind of preparation of the world around us. That the world has to be in some sense ready for this transformative process that we are supposed to achieve. Okay, last two lines on this page, 421. Through this we can understand the concept of sifting. Through the 42 journeys in the desert, even though there were no other people. Because the idea of the deserts. Now you see, the ordinary sifting of choices in life, who to love and or not love, and who to get angry with or not to get angry with, hopefully no one. that needs other people. But there's something about the desert by itself. The inyano shel midbar, the concept of the desert, hu makor haklipot. It's the source of the forces of, now klipa means shell. And the shell is like something hiding the nut inside. And that is the real force of concealment of godliness. So the desert is suddenly becoming a metaphor for ultimate concealment of godliness. Tachdon she'ein tachdon mimenu. On the lowest level, so low that there's nothing lower than it. In other words, the desert represents the lowest, lowest level. Spiritually. And there's a verse which says, Nachash, Saraf, Va'akrav. Snake, serpent, and scorpion. Dekai al shalosh klipot hatmeyot. That refers to the three impure forces of concealment. We're on page 422. Three impure forces of concealment, which are the lowest dimension. And the fourth level, v'tzimaon, and thirst. Kai al klipa raviit is referring to the fourth level of concealment. Now the fourth level of concealment, thirst, is different to snakes, serpents and scorpions. Thirst, it would seem, is quite easy to deal with. With the help of God, you have a drink of water, you quench your thirst. So it's something which is problematic, but it's relatively manageable. Serpents and snakes and scorpions are a bigger problem and remain a danger. So thirst is the fourth klipa. The fourth klipa is very much part of daily life. And it's the ambiguous dimension of daily life, that it could be holy and it could be self-seeking and egocentric. Or it could be something beautiful and sacred. So it's not obviously negative. It's got a potential to be negative and it's got a potential to be positive. So that's the fourth klipa. And all the things that the Torah forbids or permits are distinguishing between the three lower klipot and the fourth klipa. The fourth klipa is what's permitted. Now that it's permitted, we can make it into something holy. The three lower klipot are forbidden. Whatever we do to them, we can't make them holy except by refusing them and not responding to them. That's the way we can elevate them. Whereas the fourth klipa, the thirst, we quench the thirst by drinking water. In other words, this is kosher food and kosher activity, which we can do, and we can either do it in a selfish and self-seeking way, or we can do it in a spiritual and a sacred way. But so that's the ambiguous fourth dimension of the klipa. V'lachein, and therefore, lifnei atchalat avodat b'nei Yisrael, before the beginning of the service of the Jewish people, basiyat dira la'atzmuto yidbarach, in order to make a dwelling for God, for the essence of God, hayatzarich liot achna'a u'pula klalit b'midbar, there had to be a kind of quelling of this desert, Mekor HaKlipot, this source of the Klipot, kedei shiyeh koach l'adam l'avod avodato, so that the person will have his or her power to serve God in the world. So it was something that was being done in order to transform existence into the future. V'zeh mash Yisrael halchu b'midbar membet masaot. That's why the Jewish people went 42 journeys in the desert. The Azhaya Moshe Barosham, then Moses was their leader, and the sages tell us, Ha'aron haya horeg nechashim. The ark went ahead of them, the golden ark, with the tablets of stone from Sinai inside it, went ahead of them, and that would kill anything negative, all the poisonous serpents. Shezer in Yan Masher, Ichniu et Mekor HaKlipot, through this they were able to subdue the source of these negative forces. V'al-yedei akdamat inyan zeh milemaila, and through beginning this from above, she'ichniu shoresh HaKlipot, the quelling of the source of everything negative, yachol kol adam, then every man and woman is able, la'avod avodato apchatid, to serve God in their own individual way, la'asot lo yitbarach dira b'tachtonim, to make this world into a dwelling for God. So in this sense, there is a divine input which comes about through the fact that they journeyed through the desert. That journeying through the desert is giving us an input all the time now, because it's enabling us to go through our 42 journeys in our own life. There's the journeys then, and there's the journeys now. So now we come further through the generation. Second paragraph, page 422. V'hine, behold, mikevan shamasaot shebimidbar. Since the journeys in the desert, heim shenotnim koach b'avodat b'nei Yisrael, they give the strength in the service of the Jewish people, basiyat dira lo yitbarach, to make for God a dwelling, b'meshech kol adorot, through all the generations. Harei muvan, so we can understand, shasiyat adira, that the making of this dwelling, tzarich tzricha liot, has to also be gam b'dugmat inyan ha-masod, is also similar to these journeys. So there's some kind of similarity in our own lives and in our own task. V'zeh omash Moshe Rabbeinu katav, that's why Moses wrote all the 42 journeys. V'gam chatam aleim, it's as if he signed them, as it says in a certain text. His writing down is a writing and a signing. It's some kind of empowering statement. Sheze moreh, and this indicates shegam bovadat b'nei Yisrael, also in the service of the Jewish people, basiyat dira lo yitbarach, in making this dwelling for God, tzarich liyot avodat dugmat ha-membet masaot, the service has to be parallel the 42 journeys. Uchamuva b'shem ha-Baal Shem Tov, zichrona lebracha, as it's brought in the name of the Baal Shem Tov. Now this is what the Baal Shem Tov says. Shekol adam over mem beit masaot b'meshech yemei chayav. Each individual passes through these 42 journeys during the days of one's life. The masa rishon, the first journey, the first step, hu betzeitom mitzrayim, is leaving Egypt. Now, what does it mean, leaving Egypt? Haynu k'sheyetzei la'avi ha'olam. When the embryo, when the baby is born, before that, when we were just an embryo in our mother's womb, that is a metaphor for exile. In fact, exile is compared to pregnancy. Birth is redemption. So if we think of it for ourselves, being in our mother's womb was a kind of Egypt, that was the pre-stage from which we are then born, and that is the first journey leaving Egypt. We were restricted, literally, in that situation. Then we're born. And then we pass through, during the days of our life, 42 journeys. Ad sheba lebchinat eretz tova urechava, till we come to a good and broad land. I'm not sure if the coming to the good and broad land means that's the end of one's life.
Is
or
this 40, when you get to be 40? 42.
Or it's a certain spiritual achievement. We go through these 42 steps and then we reach the land which is good and broad, like the land of Israel in our own being, and then we go forward with a further dimension. Or are we to say that the entire life is a journey of 42 stages? I'm not sure how to look at it. There's an interesting story of two people at the beginning of the Hasidic movement, and they were friends, and then they met after a long time, and so something like, you know, one asked the other, you know, so what have you learned? And he said, I've learned that life is a journey of 42 stages. And do you know which stage you're at? And he said, yes. You know, like, so that idea of knowing where one is in this chain, like different steps in one's life. And I think there's a sense in which, although the story is told as you know, to show the great spiritual perception of that man, I think we all, in a sense, are on this journey, and it has you know, like different stages in the journey. And an important thing for each of us is to be able to recognize that we're at a particular stage, and we have the chain of memory going back, the steps which reach this moment. You know, everything that happened to us as a little child, and then growing up as a teenager, and all the different things that happen as being steps, and now we're at this particular step that we are on, each one of us as an individual, and then there's the next stage ahead, which is facing us. And so these are the journeys which each one of us is going through. So, v'al derech zeh b'chlalut am Yisrael. Now that applies to the individual. It's interesting what the Baal Shem Tov says applies to the individual. Then we have the concept also for the Jewish people as a whole. Shoholchim arvayim u'shtayim masaot b'meshech kol hazman. The Jewish people are going through 42 journeys through time. through history, kolel inyan hagalut ha'acharon, including this final exile, hashayach lebein ha'mitzarim, and we're now in the time, the 3 weeks between the 17th of Tammuz, last Tuesday, and then will be Tisha B'Av in 2 weeks' time. The goal is to come to the broad and beautiful land. Beyond the Jordan, Yerecho means Jericho, but it's interpreted as Gilui HaMashiach, the revelation of the Messiah, who is described as Yerecho, as it says about him, Bahariho beYirat Hashem. His scent is the fear of God, and that relates to the word Yerecho, which is like the word scent. So these are the 42 journeys of the Jewish people going through the desert in order to quell these forces of the Klipot. And the power that we get through the fact that Moshe wrote this down, and the idea that he wrote down where we're coming from. It says Moses wrote down where we came from. It doesn't only mean that journey, it means our real essence. That's the motza umakor, the source, the root of every Jewish soul. Because the source of the soul is very exalted. And something which is, and that is really the source, if we go on to the last page. And the purpose of Moshe, the role of Moses, Shahaya Shushbina de Malka. He's described like when there's a wedding, you have the groom and the bride, and you have on either side, you have a best man, like they call it in English. The best man for the groom and also someone for the bride. And so the Moshe is like the one who is helping the king, who cannot come right down into the world himself. If godliness is revealed totally in the world will, in a sense, the finitude of the world will disappear. So what Moshe has to do is reveal godliness in such a way that the world doesn't disappear. That's the role of Moses, giving the Torah and then teaching Torah, so that we're able to experience godliness in a safe way, in a safe mode. Kach hoya Moshe, and so there was Moshe drawing down godliness from above to below. And so indeed the Jewish people in our activities, we draw down from the source of our souls to the soul as it is in the body. Now you see, that's happening here. That's the reaching up to the source and drawing down into ourselves. And that's, then we go on our journey. And from this, we get this input, this empowering input from Moses in order to go on our journey and transform the world around us. And then it puts it the other way around. Because after being empowered in this way, then through our service, we then go from below to above. And through this, we fulfill the real purpose why we're here in this world. And this is something that has an effect right now, that Moshe Rabbeinu is achieving this through the Torah, and giving this Torah and Torah teachings to us, so that we, the Jewish people, have this empowerment from above, through which we are able to do that service from below to above, that we are able to make our step, that's not represented in the picture, but somehow or other we are making our step in order to reveal godliness within the world, so that the world becomes a dwelling for the divine. So, the very last few lines, may it be the will of God that through studying such things, and especially in a way that not only do we study it, but we do it as well, through this we'll come to the actual event that will come to Yarden Yerecho, will come to the River Jordan, to Yerecho, meaning Mashiach, and at once we will be redeemed, and all those who sleep in the dust will awake, and Moses will be among them with the Geula, the redemption, through King David, the Mashiach, swiftly in our days. Okay.